Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Breeling, and welcome to our first session in March. We are honored this evening to have Mary Ann Goodman, a psychiatrist who's made a number of contributions to the borderline research literature and with various focuses. But one of those I wanted to mention is that she is a co-author of a paper that was first offered by Michael McCuskey, who was our presenter last week on impulsivity and aggression tasked as endophenotypes for borderline personality disorder. And if you happen to look that up, that's a free paper because it was federally funded, so you can get a whole copy of it. Mary Ann, there's a couple other things I mentioned about Mary Ann, is that she is a recognized doctor in the health grades system. The health grades seeks ratings from patients, and Mary Ann scored spectacularly well on all the ratings. So she is now in the health grade system as a distinguished, recognized doctor. In regard to her presentation tonight, I'm very impressed because two things. One is what we really want to do to understand etiology is to do prospective longitudinal studies. Start with the conception, literally, and genetics, the development of the fetus, and go on to do a comprehensive measurement. The question there is, what are you going to focus on? And these efforts are necessarily large and expensive. And Mary Ann was a leader in a notable survey through the NEA BBT website to get input from parents. And I think there probably will be a number of those listening tonight who contributed so nicely to that. This is really a presentation in some way as a tribute and recognition of you for providing that output. The other thing is that she then did engage also, I must say I had a role. There's Carrie Moffat and her husband are leading longitudinal research with an enormous range of contributions. And they picked up when Sir Michael Rutter in England, a distinguished psychiatrist, retired. They took over a prospective longitudinal study that Rutter had designed and carried out in England. And I really talked and jumped up and down and did all sorts of things I could to entice them to include borderline measures. And Perry Moffat did. And our presenter is one of the co-authors of, a first paper looking at emergence of borderline features at age 12 with a sample the study of which began at birth. And that paper is out last year in Developmental Psychopathology. The last thing I wanted to say about Mary Ann is that she has such very exciting and good ideas. And it's just not my opinion. A group, the Families for Borderline Research, were visiting and talking to various investigators about interesting and promising areas. And Mary Ann was very gracious to spend some time with them, and they came back just enthralled. And as one of them said, give her all the money. Give it all to her. Good things will happen. So that is a real tribute when a researcher can so turn on parents and others with that kind of enthusiasm. And I think from looking through the slides tonight, we will be enchanted and enthused as well. So, Dr. Goodman, it's your show now.
Well, thank you so much, Jim, and thank you so much, Perry, for inviting me. As Jim mentioned, I'm especially thrilled as the work I'm going to be presenting is a collaboration with the NEA BPD. So if you go to the slides, you can see on the first one that the title of this talk is going to be Trajectories to Borderline Personality Disorder, and it's going to deal with both females and males. We're very excited because this is one of the few research that actually looks at male BPD as well. So what are the objectives? We were very interested in obtaining parents' opinions regarding their male and female children with borderline personality disorder as well as their male and female unaffected siblings. And the one thing you'll see about this PowerPoint as we go through, and I hope people were able to print this with a color printer because it's color-coded. Everything in red has to do with borderline personality disorder, and blue has to do with unaffected siblings. So the objectives were that we aim to describe the developmental trajectory of borderline personality disorder in both males and females, and we wanted to contrast the male trajectory with that of the females to see if there were differences between genders, with the primary goal of potentially, at some point down the road, being able to identify at-risk children, because if we can do that, we might be able to offer treatments that change the trajectory to the disorder. And we might be able to do something called preventative treatment rather than spending years and years and years of treatment once the disorder manifests. So what do we know about developmental precursors to borderline personality disorder? And when I went to the literature, I was actually pretty surprised to find that not much. And it's especially not known for males. Most studies have focused on risk factors pertaining to trauma, neglect, deficient parenting, and you can go and there'll be decades worth of literature on that. We've heard much about how sexual abuse histories may be more prevalent in males, in females rather than males. Others have noted protective factors, things such as artistic talents, superior cognitive skills, school performance, decrease the risk of borderline personality disorder. Nikki Crick, who's a developmental psychologist, she proposed a theoretical model, one of the few researchers who's looked at childhood features of borderline, and she found that there were 5 childhood indicators, and these include a hostile, paranoid worldview, intense, unstable, inappropriate emotion, overly close relationships, impulsivity, and a lack of sense of self. And I was pretty impressed by this because this starts to look like an earlier version of what we see in adults. But what about male borderline personality disorder? Is there something that we know about developmental precursors for that? Drew Weston, with his SWAP-200A, his Shedler-Weston assessment procedure, did identify profiles for individuals who met borderline personality disorder. And he found that boys with BPD were found to be more aggressive, disruptive, and antisocial, but they weren't able to look at adolescents because of the small number of males in the sample. Others have found that the DSM-4 criteria of affective instability and impulsivity were found to differ across genders and age, and that males were reported more impulsivity and less affective instability than females. And when we go through our data, we find something very similar. Data from the Collaborative Longitudinal Personality Disorder Study, the CLIPS, when they looked at childhood trauma history, temperament, and comorbid psychiatric disorders, they suggested that women and men with BPD display more similarities than differences. So moving on to our research, why do we want to look at parental viewpoints? There were a couple of reasons. We were actually very interested in looking at very early development at a time when most people don't remember their infancy. When you talk to parents, it eliminates the potential problem of negative halo or recall bias, which is particularly prevalent in individuals with borderline personality disorder. And parents have a longitudinal view of their offspring, and they also could provide information about the siblings who don't have the disorder. Now, there are some limitations that the parents may not be able to particularly say much about internal experiences, such as a sense of emptiness. So let me move now to the actual survey itself. This is a picture of the website, NEA BPD website, and you can see that the survey was actually listed on the front page, and all people had to do when they went to the website was to actually click on where it says complete a survey. And now the survey itself was actually quite comprehensive. We spent several months developing the survey. We sort of beta tested it by asking different people what they thought, and we came up with a version. It's an anonymous survey, so people don't identify themselves. It's 200 questions. It takes about 45 to 60 minutes, and for any of you who have ever filled out surveys, that's an inordinate amount of time. Personally, I get agitated after about 10 minutes doing surveys. So the fact that we were able to collect as many surveys as we were with this length really is a tribute to the parents that come to this website and their ability to really want to help others. But the survey itself was comprised of questions dealing with different epochs, and by that I mean the period of time of an infancy and toddlerhood, and we asked all these questions about, as you can see, the various symptoms, colic, separation anxiety, inability to self-soothe, and parents just had to click on those various symptoms to say whether their child had this or not. We also asked questions about that pertain directly to childhood and then moving to adolescence. Also embedded in the survey was a BPD screen, and I'll say more about that going forward. We asked demographics, both about the child and the parent. As I mentioned, the different epochs. Another section on adverse life events, what it was like for the family, the indicators of burden, different questions about their evaluation when they were first diagnosed, diagnosis and treatment. The data that I'm going to present today only has to do with the epochs. There are other papers that have come out of this survey that have to do with family burden and treatment, and I have those papers listed at the end of the survey. Okay, so here's what the actual survey looked if you clicked onto it in the NABPD website. It would take you to SurveyMonkey, and that's where the survey was actually housed. And you can see that the questions both pertain to the child with borderline personality disorder and any unaffected siblings that the parent might have that don't have the disorder. And parents just had to click on the survey items that applied to them. Now, you'll see there's a question here, at what age was your child diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and who gave the official diagnosis? We only included those patients who were actually given an official diagnosis by a professional. We had many people saying that they self-diagnosed their child. We did not include those in the actual data analysis. Okay, and here's say more about that. Okay, so over 7,000 surveys were started, and I want to just mention as a psychiatrist who does clinical research, the use of technology and the internet, I have to say this was such, it really, I realized how powerful an intervention it is to be able to use this. We would very excitedly go on every month or so to see that how many surveys were being collected, and it was very exciting because once we posted the survey, it actually took care of itself. So anyway, 7,000 surveys were started. About 5,325 of those were unfinished. So we ended up with 1,879 surveys that were completed. Again, that's the 45 to 60-minute version of the surveys, which is really quite astounding. And you'll see that 950 of those surveys we did not include in the data analysis because they didn't meet the criteria either for having given the diagnosis by a professional or for unaffected siblings. And I'll say more about that. We used the MSI-BPD, which is a screen that was developed by Mary Zanarini, and you had to score 7 or above to be included in the borderline personality disorder cohort, and you had to score less than that to be in the unaffected siblings. This was another check to make sure that we were actually getting the correct designations. So after all that was done, we ended up with 927 surveys that we were able to use. 561 of them were individuals or children with borderline personality disorder. 366 were unaffected siblings. Of the individuals with borderline personality disorder, 464 were female, and we're very excited that 97 of them were males. It took about 1 out of every 40 surveys for us to get 1 male borderline that we could say something about. So this actually now constitutes one of the largest data sets on male borderline personality disorder. The paper that we wrote up about males is in press, but I'll be presenting a lot of the data from that cohort. We also have, out of the unaffected siblings, 200 were females and 166 were males. Okay, again, this is that same breakdown, and here I'm trying to show you with the MSI-BPD, you had to have a score of 7, and again, that scale was embedded in the survey, and parents filled them out. Basically, they're the criterion for borderline personality disorder, and you had to have given a diagnosis by a professional, and that included our BPD offspring group, and then the unaffected siblings had to have an MSI-BPD score less than 7 seven or less and no BPD diagnosis. And you can see there were 952 excluded because they were in the middle of the phenotype. Okay, so who are the parents that went ahead and spent all this time filling out these surveys? Basically, the average age, first of all, I said that 95% of them were female and Caucasian, average age of about 54, a very educated group of individuals, that at least 26% had some university, 27% were university graduates, and 22% went on to have graduate school. You can see that the income range is quite high, and it does speak that you've got to have a computer to be able to, and internet access to be able to get to the NABPD website. So we are skewing towards a wealthier group. Most of them are married as well. Okay, and what about the offspring who the parents were reported on? The ages were pretty similar. Most of them were in their mid-20s. The age of diagnosis of the borderline personality disorder didn't really differ between males and females, averaging about 23 and a half years old. And the average number of MSI-BPD criteria was close to 9. Okay, and the family history of these individuals, 27% actually had another individual in the family with borderline personality disorder, high rates of depression, anxiety spectrum, and alcohol and substance abuse. And the children themselves, very interestingly, had tremendous comorbid Axis I disorders. Again, these were sort of mentioned by the parent, although we don't have by parent report. So large numbers of major depression, particularly in the females, bipolar disorder, ADHD, and a surprisingly high rate of oppositional defiant disorder, particularly in the females. Okay, now I'm going to start to present the actual data from the survey itself, and I'm going to do this in various formats. I'm a particularly visual person, so I'll present it both visually so you can get a sense, and then there'll be some statistics, so hopefully between the different ways of presenting it, it'll make sense. But we did actually also ask if there was anything about the pregnancy or labor itself that would tell us something about the development of the disorder, and here this was non-significant. How difficult your pregnancy does not seem to make a difference whether your child was borderline or not. Okay, so here is now the data from infancy and toddlerhood. And the way that these graphs work, again, I hope you all have color printers or can look at this. The borderline individuals are in red, and the unaffected siblings are in blue. And the different symptoms that we asked about in that epoch are all listed going down the column. And you can see that things like moodiness, sensitivity, unusual temperament, eating issues, and excessive separation anxiety are much more highly endorsed in the individual with borderline personality disorder than their unaffected siblings. And again, we're talking about infancy and toddlerhood at a very, very young age. Okay, and now these are predictors, so we did regression analysis to look at what predicts the outcome of borderline personality disorder in females. I'll be presenting the male data separately. And the items in blue are the things that came out to be significant predictors. So things like the inability to self-soothe, an unusual temperament, sensitivity, moodiness, sleep issues, social delay, and history of sexual abuse were predictors in that epoch of a later development of the disorder. And again, trying to do this in a more visual way, the individuals in red are the offspring with borderline personality disorder compared to the girls in blue, which are the unaffected siblings. And here we're just trying to show the same information in a different way. Inability to self-soothe, excessive sensitivity, excessive separation anxiety, and moodiness were much more highly prevalent in the BPD offspring than their unaffected siblings. And just to kind of clarify, all the parents had to do was put a check mark if they saw that particular symptom in their children at this particular age range. Okay, now I'm going to move to childhood and talk about, again, symptoms are going down in the columns. Red is borderline personality disorder female, and blue are the unaffected siblings. And here you start to see, again, certain symptoms are much more highly endorsed. And here you start to see anger, verbal outbursts, boredom. We were very surprised to see things like emptiness coming up. We didn't know that parents would be able to identify emptiness in their children, but they are certainly finding that at 40% of the people responding felt their during childhood that their females with borderline personality disorder who would be manifesting that symptom. Poor body image, trouble with grades, being a victim of bullying, lying, ditching school, conflict with authority, difficulty making friends, impulsivity, moodiness, and sensitivity, again, are very, very highly endorsed. Okay, again, we have a logistic regression that looks at which of those particular symptoms are most prominent in terms of predicting which of these children are going to go on to develop borderline personality disorder later on. And again, things that come up are sensitivity. We're starting to see impulsivity for the first time, difficulty with friends, lying, body image issues and emptiness, history of sexual abuse, and anger. Just as an aside, we were pretty surprised to see the body image issues and the emptiness manifesting during childhood at this early time frame. Okay, and again, trying to show the same data again, but in a more visual way, difficulty making friends, sensitivity, impulsivity, lying, emptiness, and body image concerns much more highly prevalent in the females in childhood than their unaffected siblings. Okay, moving on to adolescence. Same idea again. We have all the various symptoms going down the columns. You see 80% of the parents endorsing suicidality, parasuicidality, in their females who have later BPD. High rates of promiscuity, difficulty with friends, verbal outbursts, anger, odd thinking, paranoia, boredom, emptiness, body image. So the same things that were endorsed in childhood, you're now seeing at even higher levels in adolescence. And then you're sort of behavioral acting out with property destruction, recklessness, impulsivity. Again, very, very high levels, sensitivity and moodiness. In our eyes, this looked like that in adolescence you're already seeing the full manifestation of the disorder. Okay, so again, looking at logistic regression, which are the predictors of all those symptoms that I just read to you are the ones that are most important in order to determine who's going to go on to have borderline personality disorder. Moodiness, sensitivity, impulsivity, body image starts to sound just like what we saw in the last epoch, but now you add on verbal outbursts, difficulty with friends, and suicidality. Okay, and this is the same type of graph again, but you'll notice that the percentage of endorsement is extremely high. 86% were moody, 71% had verbal outbursts, 73% impulsivity, 75% unusual sensitivity, and then again 70% with suicidality, self-harm. So very high levels in adolescence. As someone who's very interested in self-harm and suicide as well, I wanted to take a little closer look at this is suicidality in the adolescent epoch, and you can see very high levels of cutting, about 50%, 60% overall, any kind of self-harm, 70% suicidality, with about 37% having had suicide attempts by adolescents. Okay, so we were then interested in asking the question, of all the symptoms in all the epochs, which were the ones that were most predictive going on to look at who's going to develop the disorder? So if we had to come up with kind of the key things to be looking at. And so this is a very interesting slide. And basically what it's telling you is that to me, this is the trajectory to what this disorder looks like. So in infancy, those children that are having difficulty self-soothing, that go on in childhood to be having issues with body image and emptiness and lying, who then, by the time they meet in adolescence, are moody, again impulsive, having verbal outbursts, difficulty with friends, and suicidality, this looks like, according to what parents have identified, the trajectory to become somebody with borderline personality disorder in females. And ended up having a very large effect size that we were able to pretty much predict which individuals would go on. Okay, so just to kind of summarize this in females, basically the prodromal features of affective sensitivity and the inability to soothe oneself can be identified as early as infancy. And then goes these individuals then go on in middle and actually in elementary school to have temperamental disturbance and affect, which is then layered upon with identity concerns. And then in adolescence, impulsivity and behavioral discontrol take precedence. And we felt that by adolescence, there's a lot of controversy in the field if you can be diagnosing this disorder in adolescence. And this data certainly indicates that for many of these individuals, the full profile is seen by adolescence. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears now and talk about males. It's very, you go to the literature and you try to find information on individuals who are male with borderline personality disorder. It's very hard to do this. Okay, so with no further ado, same kind of way I'm going to present the slides. So the individuals with borderline personality disorder are in red, and the unaffected male siblings are in blue. And again, we're now looking at infancy and toddlerhood, and you're going to start to see similar but also differences in the endorsement between the males and the females. So here in infancy and toddlerhood, you're seeing very high rates of sensitivity, moodiness, sleep issues, social delay, and the inability to self-soothe, as well as excessive separation anxiety. Same kind of idea with the predictors. In infancy and toddlerhood, it's the same issues coming up again with affect disturbances, separation anxiety, inability to self-soothe, unusual sensitivity, and a history of sexual abuse. Now done kind of visually, the same kind of red is the males with borderline personality disorder and the blue are the unaffected siblings. See, pretty, it's astounding that 50% of the parents felt that their infant, their male child with borderline had unusual sensitivity as an infant and toddler. High levels of excessive separation anxiety and high levels of inability to self-soothe. Moving on to childhood, again, you can start to see the red lines going across in much higher rates. I was surprised to see that in childhood that substance abuse is starting to become an issue, alcohol use, large levels of verbal outbursts, and again, this sort of identity disturbance coming forth with boredom and emptiness and body image issues manifesting in childhood, starting to see poor grades, again, victimization, as well as then behavioral manifestations with suspension, expulsion, lying, conflict with authorities, and then again, impulsivity, moodiness, and sensitivity. Of those particular symptoms, which ones were the most important in terms of predicting who would go on to develop the disorder in males? And it was, again, this unusual sensitivity layered upon with impulsivity, lying, body image issues. Emptiness, substance abuse did not meet statistical significance. But, again, physical and sexual abuse seems to be important in these males. Okay, and the same information again, kind of done pictorially, high levels of impulsivity, high levels of unusual sensitivity, lying, body image issues, emptiness, and then lower levels, of course, but sexual abuse seems to be important. This graph, again, in adolescence, seeing large numbers of parents endorsing these symptoms that look like the adult disorder, fighting, promiscuity, difficulty making friends, lying, odd thinking, and I'm going to come back and talk about that. Almost 60% of parents identified odd thinking, much smaller amount identifying paranoia, but this idea that the cognitive disturbance is starting to be present. Again, high levels of emptiness and body image issues. And remember, these are males. These are not females. So obviously preoccupied with how the body looks. High levels of substance abuse, and then again, your behavioral acting out around arrest, destruction, impulsivity. Which of those particular symptoms were most important in terms of predicting who would go on in the epoch of adolescence? Body image issues comes up, emptiness, odd, unusual thinking, and this just starts to look quite different from the females, impulsivity, lying, and suicidality. And you'll notice what's missing from this listing of symptoms is the affective symptoms. So there is starting to be a diversion between the males and the females in terms of what the trajectory looks like. Okay, and then again, the pictorial version of that, for those of you who like pictures, large levels of impulsivity, emptiness, lying, body image, suicidality, and odd thinking. Okay, contrasting the males with the females in terms of deliberate self-harm, again, very high levels of suicidal thoughts, threats. 27% have had a suicide attempt, and on average, 3.7 attempts, and this is by adolescents. So I think once these individuals become suicidal, it's not like it's a one-time thing. Large levels of deliberate self-harm, cutting and burning, these numbers were pretty similar across genders. Okay, so let me just summarize a little bit about the male trajectory. As I mentioned before, little is known about males, and even less is known about how males, what the trajectory looks like to becoming borderline. But our survey actually suggests that the prodromal features in males include unusual sensitivity, separation anxiety, and inability to self-soothe, and that these can be identified as early as infancy. And that in males, BPD can be viewed as an early temperamental disturbance, insensitivity and anxiety that's then overlaid with impulsivity and problems of the self, which manifests in elementary school. And then this odd and unusual thinking and self-harming behavior in adolescence. And interestingly, sexual abuse in all epochs remains an important predictor in males. Okay, so I was very interested in this question of, do these trajectories differ between males and females, or is borderline personality disorder really, it doesn't matter what gender you are, there's something about this disorder that develops regardless of whether you're a male or female. Okay, and so to do this, we looked at the data that I just presented to you, and we tried to kind of map on males versus females. And here, the blue color are males. Again, we're only looking at those individuals that go on to borderline personality disorder. And the pink are the females. And we looked at odds ratios. So what you want to look for here is the differences between the males and the females. And so what you're seeing is that in infancy and toddlerhood, if that child is manifesting excessive separation anxiety, there's a much higher odds ratio for the males that they're going to go on to have a disorder than the females. But remember, these are significant predictors regardless of what gender you are, but they seem to be even more important for the males. Same thing for sensitivity. An unusually sensitive infant has a higher odds ratio of going on for the disorder than the females. Inability to self-soothe was quite prevalent in both genders, but doesn't seem to differ between the two, as does a history of sexual abuse. Now, interestingly, social delay in the females in infancy or toddlerhood would have a stronger predictor to go on for the disorder than for the males. And also, unusual temperament, and this was the one that was the most different between the two, in females is going to be a higher likelihood that the child will go on for the disorder than in males. So I think that was the only one that was statistically different between all the other variables. Okay, now looking at the same kind of graph, but this time we're looking at childhood, and again we're looking at the difference between males and females. And the ones that were statistically different were males. If you were in multiple schools by the time you were in childhood, that was a strong predictor versus the females. Impulsivity did not differ between the two genders. Difficulty with friends. So if you've got a female child who's having difficulty with friends, that's a stronger predictor for the females than it is for the males. Similarly, in anger and unusual temperament for the females. Okay, now adolescence. Look at the graph for odd or unusual thinking. It's off the charts for the males. So if you've got an adolescent male with odd or unusual thinking, a very high likelihood that that child's going to go on to develop the disorder. We didn't see it at all in the females. So you're already starting to see now how the males and females are changing their trajectories. The other one for body image, so if this same male that's having odd and unusual thinking has some body image issues, again, you need to be thinking that this is a child at high risk to develop the disorder. Striking that emptiness, we've seen at very high rates but did not differ between the two genders. Similarly, impulsivity nor suicidality. Now, moodiness is going to be much more prevalent in the females, and that's one of the themes I'm trying to bring up is that the affective symptoms in adolescence for the males do not seem to be so much part of the profile, rather this kind of cognitive dimension. And unusual temperament, I can't say more about what that means. That's actually the wording that the parents checked on. So what's unusual about the temperament, I can't say, but clearly the parents are picking up that there's something unusual about their child's their temperament. So, but that is actually significantly much different for the females than the males, as well as this interpersonal realm with the girls is a much higher predictor in adolescence to develop the disorder than it is for the males. Okay, so part of this survey, if you didn't think we asked enough questions, 200 questions, we then had another question where we asked, is there anything else you would like to add about your child? And people could write a few words. Some people wrote several sentences, and some people wrote pages. It was so clear that the desire to explain and help others understand this disorder by these parents was so admirable. But we struggled with how to best use this information because we figured there was so much richness there. So this is a technique called a tag cloud, and what it does is it analyzes the number of times a particular word is written. Again, the question is anything unusual about your child. I'm sorry, anything else you'd like to add about your child. So the words that are in bigger font are the words that were used more frequently. So you can see in the tag cloud for males, physical, violent, burned, aggressive, paranoid, drug, sexuality were the words that really the parents were writing about for their male children. Again, sorry, these are not male children. These are the male children that went on to have borderline personality disorder. Okay, now contrast that with the female tag cloud. And some of the words that really kind of come out at you are drugs, school, depressed, boys, lying, cutting, friends, abused, parent, relationship, mother, in smaller delusions, voices. We so just thought this was quite interesting. We are hoping to work with a qualitative there are people who do qualitative data analysis that might help us be able to kind of tease some other things out of this. Okay, so I just kind of want to summarize everything I've spoken about so far. It's been a lot of data. I hope this has been helpful. But basically, we strove to kind of see if we could help identify from the parents' viewpoints what this disorder looks like from infancy on through adolescence. And if we gathered up enough parents' viewpoints, could we start to develop what a trajectory might look like? And I think we were pretty successful in doing that. And similarly, compare that to the siblings who didn't have the disorder. So in females who eventually develop borderline personality disorder, their prodrome includes affective instability, moodiness, interpersonal dysfunction, and behavioral discontrol, which develops across time. And for the males who go on to develop BPD, more importantly is this odd thinking and body image concerns, which statistically differ from the females who go on to develop borderline personality disorder. And as Jim was saying earlier on, we think this might start to help identify which at-risk children, adolescents, we want to watch if we're going to do prospective studies. And hopefully, if we can identify these children earlier on, which is kind of what we're trying to do, we might be able to develop treatments, and these children and young people might be candidates for these kinds of preventative interactions. Okay, so I wanted, this work was done with a lot of help from my collaborators, Elizabeth Diamond, Ray Goetz helped us with the statistics, Perry Hoffman from NEABPD so graciously let us post on their website, and we couldn't have done it without Perry. Uday Patel helped me with all the data analysis on these beautiful slides. Lauren Steffel and Joe Chibwasser has helped with the development of the actual survey itself. And if there are any parents who are on this call who actually filled out the survey, I want to thank you so much, because we couldn't have done this without everybody's help, and particularly the parents who spent so much time actually filling out the survey. The only other thing I wanted to kind of point out is there's three publications already, and this fourth one that's in press that directly come from this data. And I mentioned that the survey had 200 questions. This was only a portion of the survey. We have other publications looking at parental burden. So we actually asked the parents exactly how it's burdened them in terms of their own health, their finances, and other indicators of burden. We've published a paper on that. No surprise, there's tremendous parental burden. And in that paper, we also talk about the costs, the financial costs, based on what parents told us of how much they've spent, both with insurance and out-of-pocket expenses. We thought that was pretty exciting that there was some initial discussion of that, because this is obviously a lot of this healthcare is not covered by insurance. And then we have another paper that talks about the treatment utilization of these individuals. So I will stop there and turn this back over to Jim and answer questions.
Before we get to the questions, may I ask, in the prospective study you were involved with Terry Moffitt, there is, of course, a range of outcomes. Would you want to say anything about the predictors there and whether any of them were unique for borderline versus other disorders?
Well, I think that still they're continuing to do that study going forward, and I think that was just the age 13 cohort. And their screening for BPD, it isn't the full manifestation of the disorder. You're correct. These children are identified. The disorder can go in multiple directions. So many of them go on to have depression, PTSD, and I think that the trick trying to understand is which. Because there's such a high comorbidity between these disorders and BPD, is this sort of something that makes the outcome worse? Is this I'm not sure I'm explaining this well. They weren't able to determine specific outcomes of you're on this path versus that path. There seems to be sort of a if you've had a childhood that's had particular hardships, and you've got this propensity towards kind of more emotionality, and then you're coupling it with sort of environmental things that occur. I think they were able to say separations from parents and things like that. It puts you on a different course, but it's not a course unique to borderline personality disorder. These kids had a lot of other depression and PTSD as well. And I think it's for the field to try to determine the way in which borderline personality disorder interacts with those disorders, either exacerbates them or in some way these are related disorders. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but it's not that these kids go on to only develop BPD.
No, I think that's where I was really concerned at, is we sometimes get focused on a so focused on a particular order, overlook the fact that these are really disorders that are in an early stage of specification and differentiation and making true disorders. And likely they have a number of outcomes, so that actually preventive intervention that's effective could really have multiple impacts here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the one difference I'd say is that I don't know that anybody's, I mean, I think they are looking at early intervention for depression, or they have certainly have treatments for PTSD, but I don't know that anybody's trying to intervene early for this disorder because people don't think it really manifests till much later. And I think what we're trying to show is that clearly there's, you can pick up pieces of this even as early as infancy.
You raised the question here. Is this really a personality disorder that kind of congeals in early adulthood? Is personality kind of solidifies somewhat, or are we really talking of a more psychopathological disorder as that the others are?
We did not anticipate these findings. I think we were just, we thought we would see something in adolescence. We were shocked to see that parents are identifying these issues as early as infancy, and doing so in a statistically way that, so it wasn't just that, you know, we would hear anecdotal stories from parents that were pretty impressive, but when you put them all together to see that this is actually happening this early makes me think that there's almost like a genetic wiring that these kids, the way they metabolize emotion is from very early on is sort of the beginning basis of this disorder. With them, I guess, as they grow and then they're part of school or and other peers become more of an issue. But the fact that you are seeing it so early on in the trajectory was really a shock to us. We were not expecting that.
Yeah, it's very impressive. I think the sibling comparison is really important because I was struck a number of times, one on moodiness and, you know, if adolescence, you say that's just adolescence, but when you have 86% versus 30%,
that's right.
I mean, it says, "Wow, this is just not adolescence."
No, not exactly. And the adolescent graphs are they are so different. This is not normal adolescence. This is not just a kid who's more moody. Exactly.
Very striking.
I mean, the other thing I want to say about the siblings, we really struggled with this. Because it's possible if this disorder has some genetic contribution, it's possible that the siblings have a little dose also. So the fact that you're still seeing as big a gradient as you are speaks that there really is quite a difference, even if there are genetic contributions.
Right. For our listeners may recall, I just wanted to mention that we began this 2012 and 13 series with Jenny McPhee looking at infants with borderline mothers that she's been following to adolescence, and indeed there were some early difficulties there and array of other work. So I think we're really starting to tap into this early work. And then Tim Troll finished our regular sessions in the fall with presentations on the genetics of borderline, and it's very striking there as well, and very substantial genetic concordance with co-occurring depression. So these things kind of fit together. And those tapes, those presentations are available through the NEA BPT work group. Let me get to some of the questions here, because
sure.
You really tapped you know, predictably, some people are concerned about their kids, and we don't want to get into particular clinical cases. But the males with body image issues, anorexia, bulimia, that seems very unusual, isn't it?
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
The males with the body.
Yes. 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 Exactly. Yes, we were surprised to find that also. But this is the beauty of this. We don't know much about these males, and by collecting almost 100 of them, these things are starting to become quite clear that there is something going on about the way they view their bodies. I mean, you think about it in females, but the fact that it's actually so prevalent in the boys is startling.
Okay, yeah, because the question was, did she get these reversed? Is the body image
No, I did not
female?
No, it's not reversed.
Because it was low for females, then that's where you expect it to be.
Right, but I think probably because it's part of what you expect in females. It didn't differ that much between the unaffected siblings.
Siblings, right.
But in males, unaffected male siblings have no concerns about their body. They're probably, worried about pumping and keeping themselves in shape, but they're not worried about their image of their body.
Another question on the males with that astronomical odds ratio,
yes,
or odd or unusual thinking. The thing is this the case of the disorder being on the edge with psychosis and kind of the psychosis really kind of emerging with the males?
Well, there is growing literature on that we might have been underestimating that criterion 9. And criterion 9 is that transient psychotic symptoms or psychosis, particularly under stress. But there's a couple of papers now that actually are delineating the psychosis in this disorder as more than certainly I learned about. And it may be that it's more in the males. And if we've been focusing more on female populations, which is where most of the clinical data comes from, we may have been underestimating this.
Yeah, I mean, when I went through this, my head was kind of whirling. It's like, wow, never heard of that. And this is why this is so valuable for designing prospective studies, because you've got an array of things that I wouldn't have thought to include in the study.
That's exactly our reaction to
this. To just scream out the odd thinking. Now, question here. You really triggered a lot of thoughts. Can you give some examples from the input or from your experience of males' odd thoughts?
So, whether these kids go on to have depression with psychotic features, this is the problem. It's a one point in time, so I don't know where the trajectory will take them. But parents wrote in about things like obsessively worried that how they looked, spending lots of time in front of the mirror, things that you would expect for girls, worried that there was something wrong with their bodies. Not necessarily medical, but that they were somehow not developing correctly. But I think these are the kind of things that you would probably see in girls and think, oh, well, this is probably okay. This is part of what young girls think about. Some of them talked about excessive weightlifting as a result to kind of compensate. We did go back and look at some of the literature. There are male eating disorders as well. In adolescence, they're starting to focus more on that pathology. I think sort of males have been a little understudied and underrecognized. So I think some of this attention in these next studies is going to have to focus more on these questions to kind of get them in more detail. Unless the parents actually wrote something out, the survey wasn't designed to capture more than sort of a checking of yes or no on the box. So unfortunately, I can't say much more about what the exact concerns.
Gotcha. Another question here concerns the hormonal changes that come with adolescence, the testosterone surge for males and so forth for females. And by the way, are you acquainted with the estrogen work that the runner-up for the first NEA BPT Junior Researcher Prize winner did? And there was an interplay which was later replicated with estrogen and symptom expression, at least with girls.
Oh, that's interesting.
Women. But
yep.
What do we know about the influences of hormonal changes with psychopathology and development?
You know, it's not an area of my expertise, but I would certainly think that testosterone is also could be at play with some of the adolescents acting out. And it would be interesting not just to look at that with the males, but actually to be looking at the relationship of puberty to some of these symptoms, particularly the impulsivity. I would love to hear more about that particular paper that you were talking about.
I'll send you the references. Yeah, it really calls for monitoring anything that's going to affect estrogen in terms of relation to symptoms, at least with women.
Yeah.
But people, you know, understandably here are kind of wondering what might be done with preventive interventions. Do you have any thoughts about the nature of them, given this?
Well, you know, you could... I'm actually, you didn't mention this in the beginning, but I've been running a DBT program for the last 11 years at where I work and doing some DBT treatment studies at this point. But I think you could develop some kind of skills-based program that's aimed at kids along this trajectory at earlier stages. So if you've got a male who's in the childhood starting to manifest some of these symptoms, that would be a high-risk group, and whether those kids go on to be develop depression or bipolar disorder or BPD, I mean, we could actually need to follow them longitudinal anyway, but I think you could start to identify at-risk groups at these different epochs and then develop treatments that sort of target. So obviously this affective sensitivity is starting very, very early, but even by childhood, when they're starting to have identity concerns, you know, you could really get in there and start to talk about both the affect, the sensitivity, do some kind of role plays, help them develop social skills because their social delay was one of the predictors, rather than waiting to young adulthood when the full disorder is diagnosed, but you've sort of lost 10 years at that point. But I know the idea of, I know there are programs for skills in adolescence, but I'm saying you could probably even go earlier in the cascade.
Right. You know,
now, I'm not a child, and I'm not a child psychiatrist, so I would actually need the developmental people to help develop the treatments. But the whole notion of intervening earlier, I think, has got to be kind of higher on the priority scale.
You know, it's just these findings and the fact that parents, you know, over 7,000 people responded.
Yes.
It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Concern and the willingness of people to try to help out is just fantastic. And want to give Perry, if we may, there's another opportunity on the NEA website that Perry will describe here.
Yes, thank you. First of all, Mary Ann, thank you for this. I mean, having been involved with you from the early stages of sitting and thinking about what questions to ask, it's really wonderful to see what has come out of all of this work. So it's fabulous, and thank you. And we also, I just want to let, because we do have so many family members on this particular call, to let people know you can see how powerful the Internet is. You can see how powerful, thanks to lots of people, that our website gets such nice traffic.
Yes.
I see a lot of our board members on tonight. So thank them, you know, also for all that's happened to make this website what it is. But we now have a new survey up there. We've been running it for a very short time. We also have already collected impressive numbers. We're working with Melanie Harnett out of Marshall Linehan's lab and already have gotten data that we know we've already submitted for some presentations. But we encourage all family members who are on this call tonight, all professionals who are working with family members, to please encourage people to go on our website, top right corner where you'll see a survey. Please click it and fill it out. It's less fewer questions than the one that Mary Ann has gone through, but we think it'll complement the work that she's doing, and we hope that all of you will support that in filling out that survey as well. So thank you.
It's my computer clock just popped up 9 o'clock, and we do try to stop on time, and I apologize to other folks with questions. This may well be something that we should have a whole hour set aside to discuss and get input from parents and comments and elaborations and additional thoughts on. It's just great. But the last thing I want to mention here, besides and thanking Marianne for just a spectacularly informative and stimulating presentation, is the Internet is wonderful, and it has a aura of everything being free, but in fact it's not. And it costs money to keep the website up and do the recordings, and people tap into that. Psychiatrists in training have come and tapped into this and said, wow, I went through this over the weekend, and it has given me an understanding that I just never had any way at all, and what I did have was out of date that I can find by this. This can have real impact. So I just want to suggest donations are important. This is like public radio and TV, that the support of listeners is a key part of making these things possible. So thank you again, Marianne. This is just wonderful for being so gracious and putting your child at bay while you did this. And we will follow this up some more on this. And everybody, tune in next Sunday. Thank you for calling in tonight, and everybody have a great week. Next week is daylight savings time.
Thanks, Marianne.
Thank you
so much, Jim.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.